Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today, Rob Allen and I will be asking what difference video is making to court hearings and to justice in general. The advent of what is called remote justice. We'll be joined by Dr. Natalie Barham, Research Director of the Legal Education Foundation, and by Stephen Davis, a defence solicitor for Tuckers.
So Penelope, I know video hearings is an area that Transform Justice has taken a lot of interest in over the last few years. What pieces of work have you been doing on it?
It goes way back to 2015, and I've blogged, tweeted, and Transform Justice has written a report on the effect of video hearings on defendants. And what's interesting is that for a long time, it was a very sort of little known thing. Outside the criminal sphere, people didn't know that defendants and others were being linked into courts using video, like a sort of Skype call or a Zoom call or whatever. And then during the pandemic, everybody knew because the courts almost could only operate by using video links. So it all exploded in the pandemic. And I actually fought to go into the courts, to the magistrates' courts, to watch what was going on. Because I knew that video was being used in kind of new and completely different ways. And I have to say what I saw was quite alarming. I did some live tweeting. I'll just read out a bit. This defendant is on video with their head in their hands. The lawyer's on video too. The defendant's very distressed. The lawyer's just got lost from the video screen. He reappears but can't hear the court. In the end, the lawyer has to communicate with the court by phone. Defendant seems to be crying, but the video makes it really hard to tell. And that's just one of the cases I saw in the magistrate's court. Moving to Natalie, we've been talking, you and I, for many years about the impact of video hearings. In a way, we thought we were lone voices, didn't we, in the wilderness talking about this. Going back to that pre-pandemic period, why did the government and the senior judiciary, why did they want to use video hearings? Why did they have these plans for expansion?
Anyone who spent any time in courts over years will know that there are huge problems with the dilapidation of the court estate, problems with really basic facilities in courts. And essentially, the plans to introduce remote hearings came about as part of this wider drive to use technology to really increase the efficiency of the justice system, but also to remove the need for physical court hearings. So the role for remote hearings came about as part of this program that's all been about cutting costs through reducing the footprint of the court estate and trying to make efficiency gains.
In terms of research, how much research, you know, in-depth research was done on court users and their needs before they decided that they needed this massive expansion of video hearings across all jurisdictions?
So prior to the pandemic, the largest study exploring the use of video hearings in the court system took place in the tax tribunal, and there were 8 users.
So basically, the plans were made and all this money committed, and in fact, I think it's now 1.3 billion, without a huge in-depth study of the needs of users of the courts.
Yes, absolutely. I suppose this really speaks to the rationale and the incentives that were driving the court reform program. It wasn't really about users, it was about reducing costs. That was the imperative. While language around like improving access to justice was kind of overlaid as the documents around the reform program got published, that really wasn't the initial impetus. All of this reform was conceived as a way of tackling the fact that the government didn't want to spend money on the justice system. And I think that's really important for people to bear in mind.
So part of that involved closing a lot of courts, didn't it? This was wrapped up in the court closure program, which means that there are just fewer physical courts around than there were 5 or 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Rob. That's completely right. Yeah, that was the rationale. Court buildings are expensive to maintain because of lack of investment over successive years. They were getting more and more degraded and difficult to fix. So the solution was, how do we take hearings out of court buildings?
I mean, Stephen, you work in the criminal courts. Tell me a bit about how things have changed during the pandemic.
I'd call it dysfunctional chaos. For the first 8 weeks, nobody knew what they were doing. The defence community didn't know what was going on. The police didn't know what was going on. And when the first version of the protocol came into place...
So basically the protocol was to say who should be interviewed in police custody during the pandemic, and to say also that lawyers could, because of the pandemic, do their advice by video or phone.
It was effectively to save lives. And the starting point was that we weren't going to the police station at all, but for serious cases such as murder, rape, terrorism.
So once somebody's charged, then they have to normally come before the magistrates as soon as possible, maybe the next morning. But in the pandemic, that didn't happen. How did that work?
The defendant would appear before the magistrate's court on a video link from the police station. They'd effectively be put in a booth in front of a screen, and they'd appear on the screen in the court. I think one of the main difficulties, in my view, is legal professional privilege. That means that whatever's discussed in that conversation between the lawyer and the suspect doesn't go beyond those two people. But in the pandemic, suspects and defendants alike were placed in booths or confidential settings, allegedly, but they weren't confidential at all. You know, for example, the police would patch you through to the cell and you'd be on a tannoy system. I know from physically attending in police stations that that tannoy can be heard from other people in the next door cell, or the police walking by can hear it. It's not confidential.
So you're talking to your client and it's being broadcast around the police station?
Yes. At the time, one has to bear in mind that you have to operate with what you've got. And we didn't have anything better than that in some instances. So it's better to talk to your client than not at all, but you're very limited in what you can say, bearing in mind you're being overheard, but more importantly, the suspect is being overheard.
Natalie, the research that has been done seems to have found quite a lot of technological issues and difficulties. Can you tell us a bit about what you and others have found in terms of whether these technological systems actually worked properly?
Yeah, of course, Rob. Over the course of the pandemic, we did two fairly big studies looking at the experience of... I'm so sorry, give me one second.
Don't worry about your dog, Natalie, honestly, because this is about video hearings and that kind of thing does happen.
Well, it is. It's an example, right? Like this was indicative of like what happened when people were in their court hearings. So, sorry, do you want to ask the question again, Rob, and I'll have another go?
Yeah, so these video hearings are part of a big program to modernise justice. More than £1.3 billion has been spent on technology, but does it work?
It's really important to say that the two big studies that we led looking at the experience of professionals in using remote hearings took place fairly early on in the pandemic. And at that point, the technology which the government had been developing to support remote hearings really wasn't ready. And so what we saw was a proliferation of different platforms being used. So things like Zoom, Skype for Business. What we saw was really high rates of technological failure, to the extent that they were tripling the length of hearings because there were so many technical issues. These issues were particularly stark in the Mental Health Tribunal. Now, the Mental Health Tribunal is set up for patients to appeal decisions that have been made in respect to their treatment. So that could mean people who've been sectioned in inpatient settings who want to appeal against the treatment they're being given. And what we uncovered there were some really horrifying examples of patients and the clinicians who supported them being put in really unsafe situations. You had patients trying to participate in these hearings using the clinician's iPhone, for example, and some examples where you had patients who had quite severe mental health problems that included kind of auditory hallucinations, just really not knowing what was going on or actually thinking that the voices coming out of the speakers in their hearings were part of the issue.
So they were hearing voices normally, and when they were in these video hearings, they thought the voices from the other participants were part of their hearing voices, which were delusions, as it were.
Exactly. It was exacerbating pre-existing conditions, which is really frightening. And one of the big issues that I think's really shocking to me is the fact that throughout the pandemic, there's been no attempt to collect data on how often technical issues arise in relation to remote hearings. The whole point of remote hearings, right, is that they're meant to save on court time. They're meant to make things quicker and more efficient and therefore less expensive. And if actually the findings of my research and research that's been conducted globally are borne out, using remote technology actually extends the length of hearings, then it no longer looks like remote hearings are a good option when we're talking about reducing cost. And one of the things that really struck me is that when decision makers are distracted or trying to grapple with unfamiliar procedures, that's when they tend to rely more on their pre-existing biases to make decisions. And there has been no attempt to look at what the use of remote hearings has done to outcomes. And there are good reasons to think that if the technology is falling over, if people aren't getting fair hearings because they're not able to speak to their lawyers, that's going to have an impact on outcomes, which means, you know, what we're really talking here is the potential for the remote hearings to really have undermined substantive justice for people. And that should be a much bigger cause for concern than it really seems to be at the moment.
I entirely agree. What surprises me is that the government were informed about this. They knew several years ago via a report for the then Lord Chancellor, Michael Gove MP, and they said the reforms will significantly impact the way in which users access justice and the quality of justice they receive. The point being is that if the reforms were proposed to change access to justice and they've not been collecting data since 2016 in an adequate fashion, then it really does raise the question, why not? And what more can we do to change that?
If I was being deeply cynical, I would say that they haven't collected that data because they're not sure they want to know the answer, as well as it being expensive to collect data. Stephen, looking at this technological issue and the sort of many, many problems that there were in the pandemic, and I saw them when I was in court. I mean, the technology was really, really ropey. Obviously, that is an operational problem. Did it affect your client? You know, did it make their stress and anxiety different? And did it affect your ability to be a good, you know, defence solicitor to them?
I don't know is the answer, but I'm minded to say that the defence community has operated, you know, with distinction in the circumstances that were thrown their way. So what I mean by that is rapport was severed, the ability to properly communicate, you know, receiving disclosure of evidence was challenging, being able to convey that to vulnerable people in custody via a telephone call is problematic, being able to advance a bail application on a video link on a Saturday remand court is very challenging. I mean, I remember one Saturday morning during the pandemic, on a video link, I was being projected on a screen and there was a few courts sitting, but they couldn't turn down the volume and the volume was on full blast, as it were. And my voice was being projected so loud that no other court could sit. It's fair to say that everybody heard my bail application and thankfully it was successful. But who knows whether another hearing could have went differently? Who knows whether you're as persuasive as you could be in person. You don't get to read nuances. You don't get to read body language. And all that in mind, you add up all the concerns together and one has to ask themselves, are we providing adequate representation to the best of our abilities? I think, yes, we are in the circumstances, but could we do better? The answer is yes, a lot better. And I'm afraid the tech just isn't there to do this properly.
Natalie, what did the research find about what the stakeholders, the lawyers, the judges, defendants, if there is any research on that. What did they make of this? Is there any knowledge about how people felt it was going?
One of the saddest things that came out of the research with tribunal judges was the impact that kind of remote hearings had on morale. What we saw was that judges were deeply concerned, in fact, about whether the failure of technology, whether they'd done a good enough job, essentially. And I think we found some really striking things about judicial well-being being really low and in a context where we've got these huge backlogs to clear.
Sorry, if you could explain what the backlogs are.
Yeah, of course. So the backlog refers to the number of cases in the system that are awaiting trial. And I want to be really very clear on this. So prior to the pandemic, there was already a backlog of cases with delays for people waiting to have their day in court. But one of the really terrifying effects of the pandemic is that it's massively increased that backlog. And so now we're hearing reports of people waiting up to 2 years for a hearing. To finish the point that I was making about judges, I think the court service did their own research looking at, you know, perceptions of professional stakeholders in the justice system towards the end of pandemic, and they did some surveys with users. But really what shocked me was that research only received responses from 92 judges sitting in crime. I think if you compare that with the study that Transform Justice did, where you had responses, I think, from 865 magistrates, I mean, that dwarfs the number that responded to the official research. And when we're thinking about measures like the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, which are going to be massively expanding the role for magistrates in the criminal justice system, the fact that, you know, we know so little about how judges in the criminal jurisdiction feel about the use of these hearings, that should be a real cause for deep concern. Any research really that looked at the experience of the people who rely on our justice system for protection and fair treatment really came as a later afterthought. Now, the court service did do some survey research with users, but I really want to make the broader point here that in many ways, what happened in the pandemic with the rollout of remote hearings is both a symptom and a consequence of the fact that we have such little good data and evidence about the justice system. And so most of the policy decisions that are taken, they're not based on data, they're not based on evidence, and they're certainly not based on client need or user need, because we just don't know enough about the people who are in our justice system to make decisions based on those things. And really, when you think about it, that's a massive moral failing on the part of this system that reaches, you know, into the lives of people.
The court service did that survey and they did ask court users in the criminal courts about their experience during the pandemic, but we have no idea whether those court users were defendants or not. They could all have been witnesses. We just don't know because they didn't actually distinguish that. And to my knowledge, nobody, literally nobody, has specifically asked defendants for years as to what they think about going on video. And we hear at third hand that they often rather do video than be in court, say, if they're in prison because it's a long way away. But, you know, we've actually got nothing up to date at all. And that's quite shocking. Stephen, in terms of the effect on your clients, on defendants, is it more difficult to develop a rapport and to advise a client if you've only got a video in which to talk to them?
Yes, is the answer. I think Natalie raises excellent points as always. And when I think of, you know, remote technology and crime, I always think about justice. I think about bail applications. I think about trials. And I don't think there's any issue with doing a case management hearing using technology. If you're progressing something, you're getting directions on disclosure or something like that.
Well, those are more sort of administrative matters, just to keep the case going, but not involving any substantive
Absolutely.
Discussion with the defendant and so on.
Exactly.
Natalie, I mean, talking about defendants or litigants or plaintiffs or whatever, you know, you talked about how in the mental health tribunal it didn't seem to work that well. Were there any other areas of justice where people seem to struggle with video, and what kind of people struggled most?
Generally, what the research tends to bear out is that remote hearings pose difficulties for people who are older, people on low incomes who don't have good access to technology, people who are neurodiverse, so have autistic spectrum disorders, and people with mental health problems. So what we're talking about is people who are already vulnerable being made more vulnerable in the context of being able to secure a fair hearing by the introduction of this technology. One example that we picked up through the work was of an 88-year-old man who'd been in his house since 1932. And he was involved in a lengthy kind of eviction proceeding that could have seen him lose his home, the only home he'd ever known. And he didn't have access to a computer, so he couldn't access the details that he needed to participate in his own hearing to make a case to the judge for why he should stay. I mean, that ought to be kind of fundamentally concerning. And I think really we just need to do so much better at understanding how different things that we do in the justice system impact on people from different populations, whether that's people from Black and ethnic minority backgrounds, whether that's women, whether that's older people. We just need to do more. And at the moment, we don't and we can't because we don't collect the information on them. And if you're missing from the data, you're missing from the conversation and you're missing from these important policy decisions.
Stephen, on the criminal side, do you think there are particular kinds of defendants who will struggle or do struggle with remote hearings? What kind of people do you think would be most vulnerable?
I think defendants from low-income backgrounds who don't have technology available to them. Some have smartphones, but it's very challenging to log into remote hearings in that regard. Those with learning difficulties, those that are just simply find technology challenging, all of those people are at risk of being adversely affected from video link hearings. In my view, there's no better substitution than seeing someone in person, seeing them right in front of you and guiding them through it. You know, I've been representing someone with autism and their family are also vulnerable in many respects. And guiding them through the justice system is challenging in its own right. But then when you add in video link hearings, that's a whole different ballgame. The justice system is a scary place for everyone, but it's even more scarier when people have their own vulnerabilities. And we need to appreciate that when we research or discuss policy on remote technology. We can't just think about how it would impact ourselves. We need to think about the most vulnerable people in society going through the justice system and whether it's sufficient for them to progress through. I think the answer is no, it's not. And one of the biggest difficulties, in fairness, is that we are often behind the curve. And the pandemic, for us all, in many guises, we struggled to get ahead of the curve. But now that we're in, dare I say, a period of calm, we can properly discuss policy. We can properly discuss how we deal with data collection. But if we don't get the basics right, we won't be able to change it.
So, I mean, the pandemic is, well, actually, it's far from over, but the restrictions and the lockdowns, hopefully, are a thing of the past. Does that mean that video justice is no longer being used as it was in the period? Or
I think we have a hybrid. Just to give you an example, in the magistrates' court, take, for example, an overnight remand court. You see lawyers physically there in person representing those who are asking for the duty solicitor. And if you're ready to call on your case, you know, the defendant's in the cells and he's ready to be brought up. One of the difficulties that we have is that the court needs to hear the video link hearing first, because there's a dedicated slot with the prison for another defendant who's appearing. But more often than not, the pre-court video link between the lawyer and the defendant doesn't take place. Therefore, it jeopardizes the allocated slot for it to be heard before the court. I, as duty solicitor, for example, may slot in the meantime. But the point being is that we have a hybrid system in many respects. And when you have something failing from the outset, the knock-on effect in every other regard is there for all to see. And anyone just sitting in the public gallery of a magistrate's court will see the dire consequences of not getting this right.
What is at stake is nothing less than public trust and confidence in our justice system. Unfair trials serve no one. They don't serve the justice system. They don't serve victims. They don't serve the public. And so it's really, really important that we get this right, because what Stephen's talking about, not being able to speak to your client adequately, not being able to give them a fair hearing, those types of things do and will lead to cases being appealed, which will add to delays in our already overstretched and overburdened justice system. But the other point is, our justice system is routinely kind of lauded as a world-leading, world-beating system. And then when you walk in and see that the practice diverges so very far from the rhetoric, that is really deeply concerning and puts all of these deeply held kind of values at threat. New legislation like the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill and certain provisions made in the Judicial Review Bill are likely to actually mainstream the use of remote hearings and video hearings as a permanent part of our justice system. And so, was this just something that was use in the pandemic and has now gone away? Absolutely not. It's here to stay. And that means we really need to work out how to do this right.
Because presumably you both do think that there is a role for video hearings in at least some parts of some systems. I mean, how should this be taken forward and the process is improved and some clarification about when it's right and when it's not right? Who should be driving this? Natalie, what do you think?
Well, firstly, we need that data on outcomes. We desperately, desperately need to understand what the use of remote hearings, what the use of video technology is doing to outcomes in our justice system. And until we have that basic data and evidence, we're really unable to say at a fundamental level where this technology should best be used. And none of us, I think, around this table are anti the use of anything that is likely to take pressure off the justice system or improve it for people. But we really don't have the evidence that we need to understand where those good use cases are. And so that's what we need to focus on.
Stephen, I've blogged about two cases where a 14-year-old, I mean, two completely different cases where a 14-year-old heard about their conviction for murder on a video link from a secure setting. One was mid-pandemic, but one was really very recently, like a month ago. Where do you see video going, and what do you think it should and shouldn't be used for?
Well, I think you raise a horrific example. Fundamentally, the criminal justice system is there to deal with people, whether you're a victim, a defendant, a witness, a practitioner, or even a member of the public observing. We are dealing with people. We're dealing with people's lives. Often in criminal cases, nobody wins. It's as simple as that. But we can be a lot better at dealing with human beings. And I'm afraid I'm almost, I'll be blunt in saying I'm disgusted at the way we deal with people in this country. But where it's going is, I think we're heading towards online guilty pleas. The legal profession, and indeed everybody else, is being forced into this direction of travel. Of course, I don't think we're heading towards it being used for criminal trials, but I think anything that impacts on liberty, the justice system should stay well clear of remote technology. It does have its use. Video technology should be used for administrative hearings and or anything that doesn't impact on liberty. But we need to be far better at working out what it can be used for and creating an infrastructure that allows practitioners to flourish in that environment.
Rob, we've talked over the years quite a bit about video hearings, and I think this is probably the first time that you've kind of looked at them in depth. What do you feel about the kind of scrutiny that they've had?
Well, I've been quite shocked hearing some of the things that Natalie and Stephen have told us today and from reading some of the research they've referred to. I don't think there's anything like enough scrutiny, certainly not enough data. We don't know anything about the outcomes that these video hearings can produce, whether they're the same, whether they're different, who benefits, who doesn't benefit. We don't have enough research, that's clear. We don't these days have any kind of inspectorate of courts. We used to up until 2010 or so. And so there's nobody really looking at whether justice is properly being done, not just for defendants, but for victims, witnesses, for society as a whole. And I think that's a real shortfall.
Thanks, Rob, Natalie and Stephen.
Thanks so much,
Goodbye.
Guys.
Goodbye. Thanks.
And if you'd like to read any of the reports mentioned by Natalie, do look at our programme notes. There's a reference to them there. If you have experience, good or bad, of a court hearing involving video links, do tweet or email us about it. Goodbye till our next Transform Justice podcast.